Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, October 22, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the Washington Redskins trademark case and a similar trademark issue involving an Asian American rock band. My name is Will Courtney, and I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our experts Dwayne Sam and Ilya Shapiro. Complete bios were provided to you in the notice of the call, so I'll stop here and preserve more time for their presentations, followed by your questions. With that, Mr. Sam, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Happy to be here. I'm going to begin with some discussion of the Henry Tam matter. The Federal Circuit on Friday, October 2nd, sitting en banc, heard oral argument in that case, and I'm going to spend a few minutes just laying out the procedural history, what the issues are, a brief summary of the oral argument, then I'll yield the floor to Ilya, and he'll discuss the Redskins matter and some of the broader First Amendment issues that are implicated. So starting at the very beginning, Mr. Tam is the frontman for an Asian American dance rock band called The Slants. In 2010, Mr. Tam filed an application with the Patent and Trademark Office to register The Slants to gain trademark protection. The examining attorney found the mark disparaging under Section 2 of the Lanham Act, and Mr. Tam appealed to the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board. The case was dismissed for failure to file a brief, but in November 2011, Mr. Tam filed a second application to register The Slants. The examining attorney again found the mark disparaging and declined to register it. The board affirmed that ruling, and Mr. Tam then appealed to the Federal Circuit, raising two arguments. Number one, that the board had erred in finding the mark disparaging under Section 2, and that Section 2A, in any event, is unconstitutional. The three-judge panel heard argument on January 9th, 2015, and issued its opinion 3 months later. Turning first to the court's analysis or the court's disparagement analysis, Section 2A of the Lanham Act provides that the PTO may refuse to register a trademark that consists of or comprises a moral, deceptive, or scandalous matter, or matter which may disparage or falsely suggest a connection with persons living or dead, institutions, beliefs, or national symbols, or bring them into contempt or disrepute. The Federal Circuit has devised a two-part test to determine if a mark is, in fact, disparaging. Number one, the court will try to decipher the mark's likely meaning, looking to, among other things, dictionary definitions and how the mark is used in the marketplace. Second, if the mark is in fact found to refer to an identifiable group or persons or institutions, the court then undertakes an analysis to determine whether the mark is disparaging to a substantial composite of the reference group. Notably, before the three-judge panel, Mr. Tam argued that the mark does not refer to people of Asian descent. The court, of course, disagreed with it. That argument, holding that the mark likely refers to people of Asian descent, and second, that there was sufficient evidence to support the board's finding that the mark is likely offensive to a substantial composite of people of Asian descent. Turning to the constitutional analysis, Mr. Tam raised four arguments before that three-judge panel. Number one, first and foremost, he asserted that Section 2A violates his First Amendment rights both facially and as applied because Section 2A conditions a benefit, namely trademark registration, on the relinquishment of speech. Mr. Tam also asserted that Section 2A is unconstitutionally vague and that, third, the arbitrary application of the disparagement provisions violated his due process rights, and also that the examining attorney violated his equal protection rights by impermissibly hinging the analysis on the band members' ethnic identities. The court rejected each argument and affirmed the board's ruling. Most relevant to our discussion today is the court's analysis in rejecting the First Amendment argument. In particular, the court held that its precedent as established in Henry McGinley foreclosed Mr. Tam's argument. Now, that case decided more than three decades ago held that the First Amendment concerns are not implicated because the PTO's refusal to register an applicant's mark does not affect his right to use it otherwise. The court went on to say that no conduct is proscribed and no tangible form of expression is suppressed. In other words, an applicant could still use or engage in expressive activity just without the government's protection. Thus, the panel adhered to stare decisis principles and reasoned that it had followed this line of precedent for more than 30 years and saw no reason to break ranks with it today. Judge Moore, who had also issued the unanimous opinion for the court, authored a 24-page document appropriately termed Additional Views, calling for the court to revisit the constitutionality of Section 2A. Judge Moore listed more or less four reasons why McGinley should be considered an anachronism. First, the McGinley panel cited no authority for its proposition, and in the 30 years since, McGinley has been widely criticized. Third, the unconstitutional conditions doctrine and commercial speech jurisprudence have evolved significantly since McGinley. And fourth, unlike in McGinley, the PTO is now funded primarily by application fees, not taxpayers, and that will factor prominently when we talk about the spending clause and what powers Congress has in that regard. Judge Moore focused her attention on the First Amendment and unconstitutional conditions jurisprudence. First, she analyzed whether trademarks are protected speech. She reasoned that today it's unquestionably true that trademarks are protected speech under Supreme Court commercial speech jurisprudence. In fact, the Supreme Court has defined commercial speech as the dissemination of information as to who is producing and selling what product for what reason and at what price. The court has also held that the use of trade names is a form of commercial speech. And moreover, the government, in briefing below, conceded that trademarks are indeed a form of commercial speech. In addition to finding, that it's commercial speech, Judge Moore explained that Section 2A constitutes an abridgment of speech because although Mr. Tam could still use the mark, he was deprived of access to benefits provided by the Lanham Act, which enhanced the value of the mark. So, for example, exclusive nationwide use of the mark, presumption of validity, power to sue in federal court to enforce the mark, or potential recovery of treble damages if infringement was willful, among other things. Conversely, there is no federal cause of action available to protect the trademark deemed disparaging, regardless of its use in commerce. And I should add, too, that virtually all states have adopted a model state trademark bill and the respective disparagement provisions therein. So an applicant would have a difficult time seeking recourse in state court as well. Judge Moore reasoned that these burdens on speech are a clear violation of the unconstitutional conditions doctrine. Under that doctrine, the government cannot deny access to a benefit because of the recipient's exercise of constitutionally protected speech. In fact, the Supreme Court has held that to deny a benefit to a person who engages in certain forms of speech is, in effect, to penalize them for that speech. Now, Judge Moore did note, however, that the Supreme Court has wrestled with some inherent tension between applying that doctrine and the Constitution's spending clause. Now, the spending clause, under that clause, Article 1, Congress has broad discretion to tax and spend for the general welfare, including by funding a particular state or private programs or activities. And this broad discretion, in turn, allows Congress to impose limits on the use of public funds to ensure that they're used in the manner that Congress intends. Judge Moore explained that the unconstitutional conditions doctrine, at least in this case, did not conflict with Congress's ability to direct government spending because the benefits of trademark registration in no way result in a loss or direct loss to any property from the public fisc. When McGinley was decided 30 years ago, trademark registration was subsidized by public funds, and that is no longer true today. Now, admittedly, some federal funds are used to facilitate registration and enforcement. For example, their PTO employee benefits or enforcement litigation. But according to Judge Moore, if such attenuated spending could implicate the spending clause, then every benefit or program provided by the government would implicate the spending clause as well. Turning then to Judge Moore's First Amendment analysis, in addition to finding a clear violation of the unconstitutional conditions doctrine, Judge Moore thought that Section 2A was also a clear example of viewpoint discrimination. That is, the law made it possible to register trademarks that refer to a certain group in a positive way or a non-disparaging manner, but it denied trademarks that refer negatively to the same group. Although viewpoint discrimination laws are presumptively invalid, Judge Moore noted that it's still an open question whether strict scrutiny applies to such restrictions on commercial speech. The Sorrell decision from the Supreme Court a few years ago hinted at it, but I don't think it's been established since, and perhaps Ilya will touch on that. In any event, Judge Moore reasoned that Section 2A cannot survive even under intermediate scrutiny, using the Central Hudson test. That test, assuming lawful, non-misleading speech, requires the government to show that there's a substantial government interest that's directly advanced by the law or regulation, and that it's no more extensive than necessary. Judge Moore explained that the government did not have a substantial interest in discouraging the use of disparaging marks, because a substantial interest must be unrelated to the suppression of a disfavored message. And so without a substantial government interest, Section 2A cannot withstand Central Hudson analysis. Further imploring the Federal Circuit to revisit its precedent in McGinley, Judge Moore noted that the opinion was written only 1 year after Central Hudson, and it was really decided against a background of law where the First Amendment had only recently begun to apply to commercial speech. And significantly, at that point, neither the Federal Circuit in McGinley or any other court for that matter had analyzed Section 2A under the unconstitutional conditions doctrine. So persuaded by Judge Moore's compelling analysis, the Federal Circuit, without being asked, vacated the three-judge panel opinion and scheduled the case for oral argument before the entire bench. The parties were instructed to brief only one issue, namely, does the bar on registration of disparaging marks in Section 2A violate the First Amendment? Counsel for Mr. Tam raised largely the same arguments advanced by Judge Moore in her additional views. The government, on the other hand, really seemed to frame its argument around three principles or three arguments. Number one, that the Lanham Act grants trademark holders a government subsidy or other transfer of wealth. Number two, that trademarks are government speech, particularly once they're published on the principal register. And number three, that denial of disparaging marks is a valid exercise of Congress's spending power. During oral argument, the court touched on several of these themes throughout, including viewpoint discrimination, government speech, the spending clause, and copyrights. Counsel for Mr. Tam began his argument by launching into a facial attack on the Lanham Act, noting that it is unabashedly viewpoint discriminatory. The court did not immediately challenge the premise of counsel's argument, but instead it queried whether stare decisis would be an impediment to overturning Section 2A. The court appeared to retreat somewhat from that line of questioning after counsel noted that there had been dramatic changes in trademark and First Amendment jurisprudence, particularly in the realm of commercial speech, and on that basis, stare decisis should not foreclose review. The court also sought clarification on whether the commercial speech doctrine would be the appropriate framework to analyze the case. Counsel for Mr. Tam, as well as the ACLU, explained that under any level of heightened scrutiny, Section 2A should be held unconstitutional. And the panel did seem to agree, or at least it did not dispute, that Sorrell and the Supreme Court's recent decision in Reed would provide the appropriate standard of review. The court also queried whether Section 2A is really viewpoint discriminatory, since the band, in any event, may decide to keep its name without the trademark protection. And indeed, this sort of hinges on one of the government's primary arguments, which was that Section 2A does not prohibit Mr. Tam's speech. Counsel for Mr. Tam responded that the far more important question would be the chilling effect that the law has on tens of thousands of other applicants who might seek trademark registration. From that point, the court tried to move in and really tried to unpack the government speech spending clause or spending power analysis, and really did so somewhat surprisingly without referencing at all the Pro Footballer Redskins case. Appellant's counsel, Mr. Tam's counsel, noted at the outset that the board and numerous cases have construed have made clear that trademarks are not to be construed as the government's stamp of approval. The court seemed somewhat dubitante and was really pressing for a way to distinguish the Rust and Davenport line of cases from the case before them. And one of the things that they did was they really seemed to rely on, or not rely, but really seemed to embrace some argument from ACLU's counsel that the Supreme Court's decision in Velasquez was an appropriate way to distinguish the government speech cases as well as the government spending clause cases. And as ACLU counsel explained in that case, Velasquez really stands for the proposition that viewpoint discrimination is not proper when the government does not itself speak or subsidize transmission of a message it favors. ACLU's counsel also used this opportunity in discussing Velasquez to sort of reframe the discussion around the unconstitutional conditions doctrine. A slim majority of the en banc panel seemed to buy into the idea that under this doctrine, the regulation of private speech through viewpoint discrimination is never a legitimate government intention. Perhaps most significantly, several members of the court seemed dissatisfied with the government's inability to offer a persuasive argument as to why a similar statutory regime would not pass constitutional muster in the copyright context. And to sort of unpack that, you know, the court went through several hypotheticals to try to get to why the copyright would be an exception. And the government, at least based on the facial expressions and some of the reactions from the panel, was not satisfied with the government's answer. The most notable holdout seemed to be Judge Reyna. He sought to distinguish copyright and trademark jurisprudence on the basis that the former is a form for expression of the arts, whereas Section 2A's regulation is aimed at cultivating stability in the marketplace. Now, no other panel member appeared expressly to adopt this view, and you know, the case law is pretty clear, I think, that marketplace regulation is permissible only insofar as it relates to avoiding confusion and determining the source and origin of goods and services. Having said that, the court really sort of ended the oral argument there, and I wouldn't bother to sort of offer a prognostication as to how I think the panel will come out. I will say that it seemed as though there was a slim majority that's leaning toward overturning Section 2A, but I will at this time yield the floor to Ilya to discuss the Redskins matter, how it's related to this case and some of the broader First Amendment implications.
Thanks, Dwayne. That was a great overview of the Tam case and some of the technical issues at play, which should be similar in the Redskins case, even though And Wayne mentioned this, it was surprising that the Federal Circuit did not refer to the Redskins case at all. And that's the name of the case is Pro Football versus Amanda Blackhorse et al. In that case, less than a month after the Walker versus Texas Division of Sons of Confederate License Plates, Sons of Confederate Veterans case out of the Supreme Court, which I'll discuss shortly, Judge Gerald Bruce Lee in the Eastern District of Virginia ordered that the Redskins' trademark registrations be canceled because they may disparage Native Americans. That's a direct quote, because they may disparage. That's the relevant statutory authority. In part because Section 2A of the Lanham Act doesn't implicate the First Amendment at all. The Redskins can continue to use their logos and marks and what have you. They just won't be registered. And secondly, because trademarks, again, citing the Walker case, are government speech. This, to me, was a bizarre ruling, compounding what I thought was the Supreme Court's error in finding that specialty license plates constituted government speech, and therefore the government can decide how to speak. Now, I should caveat this whole discussion by saying that I'm not an IT specialist, and neither is Dwayne, for that matter. Even you know, working at a think tank, sometimes you go on TV or are expected to comment on things on which your expertise, so-called, doesn't rise to the level of what you would want in an academic or a legal advice to a client setting, but even for TV purposes, I'm not an IT specialist. So if there are people like that online, I very much look forward to your comments and questions about anything that we've said. But really, whatever you think of the wisdom in keeping the moniker of Washington's professional football team, it should be uncontroversial that the name and logo is protected by the First Amendment. These similar sorts of issues came up with the Confederate flag in the South Carolina context. Certainly, when you fly the flag in a at a government building, then that is government speech. But if, say, someone puts the battle flag on their bright orange car with the ensign painted on top, that is their right. So part of the issue here is, our trademark registrations, among other types of IP, I don't know how much this reflects copyright or patent as well, is that really government speech? Because if it is, then in a sense, then I first learned of the Redskins ruling through the government-endorsed Washington Post in an article that appeared on my government-endorsed Facebook feed that I was checking on my government-endorsed iPhone. All of these are, of course, trademarks and involve copyrights and patents underneath them as well. It should be uncontroversial that we can condemn speech that we don't like while recognizing that it's protected by the First Amendment. Unlike in most countries, our Constitution prohibits the government in whatever form from punishing people for the content of their expression. Although there's been some pushback to that. In response to, you might recall, last spring or late winter, the racist chant scandal at the University of Oklahoma. Well, Boston College law professor Kent Greenfield, writing at The Atlantic, said that we're told the First Amendment protects the odious because we cannot trust the government to make choices about content on our behalf. That protections of speech will inevitably be over-inclusive, but that is a cost we must bear. If we start punishing speech, advocates argue, then we'll slide down the slippery slope to tyranny. If that's what the First Amendment means, Greenfield is saying, then we have a problem greater than bigoted frat boys. The problem would be the First Amendment. So law professors here are arguing that the government should be able to censor speech when it thinks that it's too offensive. This is disturbing. And now it may well be, I should say, that the Fourth Circuit, when it hears the Redskins appeal, the Pro Football appeal, will affirm Judge Lee's order on different grounds. And indeed, it could well be that the Federal Circuit won't reference Walker or the government speech doctrine either. It could be that there's a circuit split based on reasoning or of result. We'll have to see what happens to that. But I think this line that we're seeing after Walker with the Redskins effectively being the decision's first victim is disturbing because it's previously been unquestionable that offensive speech is protected by the First Amendment. The flag-burning case, Texas v. Johnson, the court said if there's a bedrock principle underlying the First Amendment, it is that the government may not prohibit the expression of an idea simply because society finds the idea itself offensive or disagreeable. Yet too often, offensive speech, this is me talking now, no longer quoting the case, offensive speech seems to be protected begrudgingly, perhaps because it's difficult to draw a line between offensive and inoffensive speech, implying that if such a line could be drawn, then banning offensive speech might be desirable. Or its protection comes with an apology, a reluctance to fully commit First Amendment protections to the most boorish and crass among us. That's why Cato, joined by P.J. O'Rourke and Nat Hentoff and Nadine Strossen and Lenny Bruce's lawyer, for that matter, filed a brief in the Walker case defending the boorish and crass among us, as it were, the right to offensive speech as worthwhile on its own. I don't think that offensive speech should be incidentally protected just because we don't know how to draw that line, but inherently valuable to a should be considered to be inherently valuable to a free society. Lenny Bruce, remember, 50 years ago, more than 50 years ago, it's about 55 years ago now, was arrested on stage at the Jazz Workshop in San Francisco. It's odd how these things come up. But even if, again, it's hard for me to see how a mere trademark registration or copyright or what have you is a government imprimatur. If it is, then the way that the public forum is designed, it's not an exclusive sort of good like a park or some other government space. It shouldn't be discriminating based on the content. We see an increasing skittishness, and I think this is one example of it on college campuses, many of which are, of course, government-run, where the reigning belief seems to be that if someone is offended, then someone else must be guilty of something. And we see it in Europe in speech laws that are creeping across to criminalize everything from racist tweets to, in one interesting case, asking a police officer, quote, "Is your horse gay?" And then there's the residents of a Massachusetts town, which a few years ago, I don't know, maybe they were trying to recapture their Puritan roots, imposed a $20 fine for public profanity. These are all examples of, I think, the government going overboard. After all, someone is offended by anything. And it can't be that in the context of intellectual property, that everything that gets intellectual property protection, the government says is okay or it agrees with. It's hard to understand how a government could agree with certain types of things anyway that don't seem to express a position whatsoever. Well, to summarize our brief that we filed in the Walker case, offensive speech, I think, is valuable for two main reasons. First, that it contributes to the marketplace of ideas. It helps establish the parameters for public discourse, and in so doing expands what can be acceptably discussed. If there's an outcry or a boycott of the Redskins because of their logos, that seems to be self-policing. If there's some allegation of defamation, we have laws to go after that as well. Secondly, the right to speak or behave offensively is an essential aspect of personal autonomy. Offending prevailing mores and values is as crucial to defining oneself as supporting them is. This might appeal to Justice Kennedy or anyone who is thinking about kind of the value of inherent dignity and personhood and self-expression. This has been important in the gay rights community. It's been important in a whole host of activisms of the left, right, or otherwise. Sometimes you use tactics that the most polite among us might not to get attention, and move your argument, whatever it might be. A bottled-up offensive person is as uncomfortable as a Victorian at a punk concert, and both need each other for definition. By offending, a person stakes a claim to an identity that's crucial to her development as a human being, and the government has no role in constraining that development within the boundaries that are delineated, whether it be by the Texas DMV, the Patent and Trademark Office, or any other government entity. Now, again, I really don't have a position on some of the IP technicalities or analysis regarding a quasi-public forum, other than to say that, again, trademarks, copyrights, these sorts of things are not exclusive, or they're not finite in the sense that if the Redskins are allowed to keep their trademarks, it doesn't lessen the ability of others to have trademarks. And it seems that this is no different here than a law that explicitly bans political speech, whether in general or of one form or another. And I think that offensive speech, whether considered to be government speech or not in this context, should receive the same protection, particularly at a time when foreign laws prohibiting offensive speech lap up against our shores and speech codes threaten to spill over from our campuses. A free society shouldn't walk on eggshells, it should sleep on nails, and any attempt to sand those down won't result in will not only result in less freedom, but it'll create a less interesting and dynamic and robust society. As for the Redskins in specific, my personal view on the kind of the merits of the matter, quite apart from the law, is that the Skins should keep their name but change their logo to a Red Bliss potato, and we'll let the censors figure that one out, whether it's treated the same way as the slants in an ironic form or allowed to prosper. We'll see. I just have a hard time believing that Judge Lee's justification, that's the Redskins judge in the Eastern District of Virginia, that exactly will be upheld. I think there are more subtle, less bizarre ways of reaching the same result, even if I might disagree with it. But we'll see. I mean, these rulings by the Fourth Circuit in the Redskins case and by the Federal Circuit in In re Tam are going to be very important. And combined with, we haven't even discussed, but it could well be that the Reed v. Gilbert case about signage from this past Supreme Court term will also play a role in terms of time, place, and manner restrictions, how they intersect with content, what some might claim are content-based restrictions. So I'll leave it there. And like I said, this is not an area I was expecting to get into. And as far as the intellectual property niceties, I'm sort of learning as I go. So if there's some wrinkle here that I've missed, I'm all ears, and I'm happy to incorporate that in my future commentary on these issues.
Mr. Sam, do you have any comments on Ilya's remarks before we move on to audience Q&A?
No, I'm ready to take questions.
All right, then. I will now open the floor to audience questions. In a moment, we will all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then pound. Again, to request the floor, enter star and then pound. we have no audience questions so far. We do have a crowd on the line. And, oh, here we go. Let's move to our first audience question of three.
Anthony Jefferson, I have a quick question. How does, I guess, the First Amendment right and libertarianism, how would that work in terms of protecting the trademark? For any individual, libertarianism, trademark protection, and the First Amendment.
Okay, I assume that's a question to me. Libertarians have different views on intellectual property, from the kind of the strongest position represented by people like Richard Epstein and Adam Mossoff, who believe that intellectual property is just like any other property, and when you create something from your mind, you mix it with your labor, you invent something, or you write something down, you design something, that is yours, and you shouldn't, other people should not be able to free ride on your efforts by simply using those. Otherwise, mm-hmm. There is no incentive for people to create or invent or design. There are, at the other extreme, libertarians who believe that intellectual property is no different than any other government monopoly, that the government grants it, and it creates it, and therefore distorts the market. And there's kind of a law and economics analysis that's done kind of in between. There's a lot of people, libertarian or otherwise, think that there should be protections for intellectual property. Probably certainly in the academy, I think the majority position now, or among libertarians in general, is that regardless of whether we should have intellectual property in the first place, the protections there now are too much. The Mickey Mouse Protection Act for Disney to secure for longer and longer periods certain copyrights. Patent protections perhaps are too strong or last too long, such that most patent suits aren't regarding true infringements but by trolls that just sit on patents that aren't really being used for the good of society or that creates incentives in any way. In the case of trademarks and what we're dealing with here in terms of offensive speech, I basically outlined the libertarian position. I don't think my views represent a deviation one way or another, that at the end of the day, regardless of how you feel about intellectual property, it's not government that should be judging when something is too offensive or incorrect or stupid or anything else.
Okay, I just wanted to be clear on that, what the balancing test was in your estimation. Between libertarianism going to the extreme and between libertarianism moderating the First Amendment interests.
Well, I don't think I would apply a balancing test, and it depends. There are different kinds of First Amendment cases, I suppose, and the, you know, I think any libertarian would recognize the propriety of or constitutionality of time, place, and manner restrictions. You can have an ordinance prohibiting people yelling things from a loudspeaker going down a quiet street at 4 a.m. And, mm-hmm. and things like that. But generally, libertarians are very protective of speech and other First Amendment concerns, whether in the context of individuals, whether in the context of political campaigns, commercial speech, or otherwise.
Okay. Thank you.
Let's move on to our next caller.
This is David Applegate in Chicago with a comment, not a question. Meaning no disrespect to Mr. Sam, I pretty much agree with everything Mr. Shapiro has said, including and in the. But it seems to me that ultimately these cases are not likely to get resolved at this rarefied level of intellectual review should they ascend to the Supreme Court, which seems to me to have become an increasingly political body that is likely to make a decision less tethered to the law than either the Fourth Circuit or the Federal Circuit. And I wonder if either of the speakers has a comment on that.
Dwayne, I just talked for a while. I could chip in, but if you have something to say on this.
No, I think I would certainly concur with that sentiment. You know, these are very sort of thorny issues, very politicized issues, and, you know, it's difficult to sort of gain any sort of consensus or finality in the judicial realm. And, you know, these have been these matters have been playing out for so long in the public eye, and they've really sort of gained momentum and traction not because of any particular action from a judicial body, but really sort of the public, clamoring, to have these issues resolved. So I certainly agree with the caller's sentiment that, these things, because they're so heavily politicized, that the judicial forum may not put these issues to rest.
I think if this gets to the Supreme Court, we aren't necessarily going to see a 5-4 liberal conservative split with Roberts in the middle. And I say Roberts because on speech issues, he tends to be a swing vote. Kennedy is very protective of speech and is not a swing vote. Although on some types of speech cases, there have been a number that have gone 8-1 with Alito as the lone dissent. The funeral picketing case comes to mind. Or the Animal Crush videos, I believe, as well, the Stevens case earlier. But because this involves intellectual property and involves government registration, that's a bit of a wild card. I don't think at all that it's necessarily transfers directly from the Walker case, even if the federal and or Fourth Circuit's rule for the government by citing Walker heavily. Because this is just speculation, of course, Thomas provided the swing vote in Walker joining the liberal justices. Some people thought that Thomas did that because it involves the Confederate flag, given Thomas's history with the cross burning case and so forth. I don't think it's that. Eugene Volokh had a very interesting post speculating on why Thomas joined the Breyer majority, saying that he tends to be solicitous of state regulations, and here, of course, it would be a federal regulation to which he's, I think, less solicitous. So it's not at all clear that even on Walker grounds that we would have the same lineup. But it depends how they choose to frame the issue and how narrowly or broadly they do that as well. And obviously, what kind of that depends a lot on what kind of opinions we'll see from the appellate courts.
Thank you both very much.
We still have one more question in our queue. Before we take that, though, I want to make a quick programming announcement. Our next teleforum will take place tomorrow afternoon at 2 p.m. We'll be discussing the Yates Memo, a document issued in September directing federal prosecutors to focus their efforts on individual corporate wrongdoers and not just corporate entities. You can check for new teleforum calls as they are scheduled at fedsoc.org/teleforum. We have one question remaining in our queue. If you'd like to ask your question, please hit star and the pound key now. We'll go to the next caller.
Hi, this is Eric Brady at USA Today. Hello?
Yep.
Yeah.
We can hear you. Please go ahead.
Okay, very good. If the federal court invalidates Section 2A of the Lanham Act, is that something that takes effect immediately, and how would that affect the Washington team name case next summer, or is that something that the act stays in place until the Supreme Court were to rule?
Well, to clarify, this is Duane speaking. The provision under consideration in NRE TAM is the disparagement clause, not the entire provision of Section 2A. It also has a scandalous and immorality clause as well. But presumably, were the Federal Circuit to overturn that narrow provision of Section 2A, there would be the losing party would seek cert before the Supreme Court, and they would take up the issue and then attempt to bring some sort of finality to that.
Yeah, whenever a federal statute is struck down, or a state one for that matter, typically the government appeals or seeks a high court review, and the mandate is stayed pending the final outcome. We could well see a result where, because there's two appellate courts here, and they reach opposite results. It doesn't mean that the disparagement section or 2A more broadly is applicable in part of the country and not in another. It would mean that, first of all, it would mean that the Supreme Court will almost certainly take the case. And secondly, I think that it would be that result would be stayed until that all is processed.
And what effect do you think it would have on the case next summer, even if the Supreme Court hadn't weighed in yet, if the disparagement part of 2A was struck down?
The case next summer, sorry?
Yeah, the Washington NFL team case. What effect would a ruling on disparagement?
The Fourth Circuit isn't bound by what the Federal Circuit does, so it would take note of it, and it would either agree or disagree or agree on other grounds. It's perfectly free to do what it thinks best.
I would add, too, just in terms of bigger picture, because you seem to be inquiring about what role the Supreme Court might play in this case, and I would say that, you know, to the extent that a circuit split develops, given the 30 years of relative quiescence on the constitutionality of Section 2A, I think that would certainly go a long way towards provoking the Supreme Court to weigh in on the matter and to bring some resolution to it.
Good. Thanks.
Our lines are now wide open for questions. If you'd like to ask a final question, please hit star and the pound key. But seeing none, we do have one more. We'll go to that last caller.
Hi, this is Will Trackman with Littler Mendelson out in Denver. I was listening to the commentary on whether we trust the government to decide what is disparaging and what is offensive. And, you know, that has some initial appeal to me, but then I think, well, there are other circumstances where we do trust the government with that decision. I think of FCC regulations where the seven famous words that you can't say on broadcast television, or perhaps notwithstanding the famous Larry Flint case, courts enforce decorum rules all the time. Don't swear during oral argument at the judge, right? So there are plenty of instances I can think of where We do give a little bit of trust to the government to decide what is and what is not offensive. What makes this situation different than those other situations?
Well, I think for starters is that, you know, I think there's consensus that there are certain types of speech that are unprotected. And what makes this case a little bit different and perhaps a bit more insidious is that allowing Section 2A to sort of encroach and envelop on so many different areas of protected speech seems to be anathema to the First Amendment. We're not talking about the unprotected areas of speech. We're talking about protected areas of speech that the Supreme Court has recognized time and time again. And what Section 2A is attempting to do here is to really guard against hurt feelings or just people being offended as a general matter. And I think Ilya hit it right on the head, you know, when he said earlier that, you know, someone or anyone can always find reason to find offense in something. So I think that's where Section 2A is a little bit different, that it's not just it's not really concerned about the unprotected types of expressive speech, but it's really sort of a catch-all for anyone that might find offense in any particular thing.
And to put a finer point on it, there are a handful of categories of expression that the Supreme Court has held to be unprotected: child pornography, incitement of violence, obscenity, whatever that means. I know it when I see it, right? The seven dirty words are part of the obscenity, and we recently have seen some fleeting obscenity cases relating to Bono at an awards show and Janet Jackson with the wardrobe malfunction and things like that, the FCC regulation, which was decided on other grounds by the Supreme Court. Offensive speech, however defined and whoever gets to decide, isn't on that list. And so it's not a kind of prima facie unprotected. And then we get to the issue of time, place, and manner restrictions, because even protected speech can be banned or punished if not made at certain points, like oral arguments, say. you know, you're welcome to yell out things at Speaker's Corner or in the middle of the street or what have you, that you're not at oral argument. That's a very apt example. What are trademarks? Are they closer to you know, yelling fire in a crowded theater or inciting violence or any of these other things, or are they closer to these protected things that some people might not like? Or it could well be that your trademark is protected, but if your trademark is something that's would disturb some sort of formal ceremony. I don't know if you had hesitate to even come up with an example, but maybe something that's indecorous that's worn. Let's say a bikini at the Supreme Court or something. That's you know, I like bikinis, but maybe not appropriate or the equivalent for men either. I don't mean to be sexist in that. A swimsuit of any kind. Let's just say a swimsuit of any kind, or the verbal equivalent of that. That's perfectly appropriate in many circumstances, but would not be at oral argument. And so, you know, trademark registration. How does that fit into that context?
We do have time to take another question. If you'd like to ring in with one, please hit star and the pound key. We'll pause a moment this time. And now, seeing none, any closing remarks from either of you, Duane and Ilya?
Well, I think both of these cases raise very important First Amendment considerations, and you know, we didn't talk too much about you know, the Reed case or the Sorrell decisions, but I think both of these cases are sort of harbingers of perhaps what's to come down the road in terms of the Supreme Court bringing clarity to its commercial speech jurisprudence. And you know, as a somewhat of a court watcher, I'm hopeful that the Supreme Court has that chance to bring some clarity to two very important issues.
I'll just say that I'm very curious what the appellate courts will do. I'll be surprised if the Fourth Circuit essentially rubber stamps or adopts the exact same reasoning as Judge Lee. It certainly seems like the Federal Circuit is struggling in a lot of different helpful and interesting ways. You know, what we've discussed is going to be radically shaped by what these courts come up with. So I don't want to read too much into simply what the district courts have done.
Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank you both for your comments. Thanks to our audience for joining us, and we'll hope to hear from some of you for our next call tomorrow afternoon at 2 p.m. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.